Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today we've got a real pleasure. My good friend Larry Autumnleaf has returned to the Explaining History podcast, and we're going to talk about some of the difficulties in pedagogy surrounding the civil rights movement and in the era of Black Lives Matter, and the difficulties, particularly from a UK perspective, of telling the civil rights story. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce, once again, Larry Autumnleaf. Thank you.
Okay, so welcoming back to the Explaining History podcast is my good friend Larry Autumnleaf. If you've been following the podcast for a while, you'll know that Larry and I talked about China and Mao and the Sino-Soviet split last year. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you.
Today we're talking about the kind of the historical roots of what we currently see as the Black Lives Matter movement, but it's really a kind of a continuation of, I wouldn't even call it the civil rights movement, but the struggle for the struggle for Black freedoms in America since the end of the Civil War. Firstly, I guess, you know, here we are, two UK-based teachers. And part of the way in which British students understand this, or the only way most British students understand the struggles for equality in America, is through the way in which they're taught in schools, which there are, I would say, kind of problematic areas with. Mm-hmm. My view has often been that the civil rights module of America, when we were teaching America at kind of GCSE, which for those listening abroad is the kind of the standard high school qualification here in Great Britain, is that from 1945 to 1965 there are a series of struggles, and then up to the end of the 1960s, following the death of Martin Luther King, the narrative that we teach suddenly sort of starts to kind of fizzle out. There's some mention of like the Black Power movement, and then there's some sort of changes in the conditions that Black people experienced in the 1970s, and then when we get into the 1980s, there's almost nothing to say. And of course, that's not true, is it?
When I taught, I taught an A-level course on civil rights, and the years of that were 1945 to 68, which do kind of imply, as you are, that you know, civil rights ended in 68. You know, there was a problem, it was solved. It also infers that there wasn't a problem before 1945, and there's something magical about that year, whether it be the end of World War II or something, presumably, you're going to be taught about on the course. So it kind of starts from that very tricky situations. Yeah. Why, like, I think when you suggested we have a chat and try and link it before, during, and after through to BLM, that it will hopefully be an interesting listen for your subscribers.
Yeah, because I mean, I think as what you have, if you walk away from GCSE or A level with the assumption that isn't everything all right now, then that surely has an effect when you see protests in America to thinking, well, what are they moaning about? You know, what is the problem? Is this not solved? And the answer is, well, of course it isn't. But let's rewind first. If we're talking about beginning, you know, the before, during, and after that period, 45 to 68,
mm-hmm.
let's just take that. For now, we have to really rewind to the end of the Civil War and the conditions in which African Americans were emancipated. What do you and the period that follows it of Reconstruction? What do you see as kind of the main issues there for anyone trying to kind of make sense of this topic in that period of time? Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting conversation that you said begins with Reconstruction. Now, when I taught the American Civil War, Reconstruction was a unit chucked on at the end, 1865 to 1877. You know, they even give you the years for that. And for me, that's a little bit wrong. Now, we would probably agree that 1877 is wrong because we see these issues as still existing today. But I also think 1865 is the wrong date to start it because that's obviously the end of the war. Whereas I think you can possibly date the civil rights movement back to Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which is really where the Civil War goes. From one of about retaining the union of all the states and to an actual civil rights. These are the lives of black people who were involved in this war, you know, for, fighting it, but also is the war about them? So I think that's a really interesting place to kind of begin. But Reconstruction, or at least, you know, is a bit strange, two English people talking about Reconstruction. However, Reconstruction itself is a very kind of shaky premise. You know, you've got radicalism pre-Civil War, you know, people like John Brown in 1856 and then more famously in 1859, who were certainly fighting for what they perceived to be racial equality in far more 20th or even 21st century terms than what a lot of the early...
Yeah.
civil rights protesters are campaigning for. I think, you know, I've never taught it, but even in the American War of Independence, you have the British trying to get slaves over to their side by promising them their personal freedom,
yeah.
their own manumission. So it's a tricky subject that has a huge political layer. You know, you will hear a lot of Americans say that the Civil War wasn't about slavery. You know, it was about states' rights. Now, rationally speaking, which is a bold thing to say when what I'm actually going to say is just my own view, but I'm going to say that's rational, is that the Civil War was about this thing, states' rights, but the state right was whether an individual state can have or can spread or can prevent the spread of slavery.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a war about Louisiana having separate stamps from New York or Mississippi wanting different levels of tax from Ohio. You know, it was a slavery conflict. And I think that really needs to be accepted as a starting point to kind of have this conversation at all.
Yeah,
I don't know what you would think about that, Nick.
No, I would entirely agree, and it comes down to these conceptions of freedom that exist all the way back to the founding of the United States. The idea that is this a union where all men are free, or is this a union where there is a freedom for you know, some commercially minded savvy chap to own the kind of the human means of production, you know, to own other human beings, which are conveniently dehumanized or seen as less than human. There was, you know, when you see the development of the southern and the northern states, you on the eve of the Civil War, you're talking about two fundamentally opposed cultures. There were the southern states saying, in essence, you know, you northerners, you just don't understand how it works down here. We're civilizing these savages, and also if you emancipate them, not only do you, you know, take the knees out from under our entire society, you know, entire economy, entire way of life, but you would also make the unthinkable happen of Negro slaves being able to kind of compete on equal terms with poor whites. There's a very interesting study done. I forget the author, but I will look it up and put it in the notes under this podcast about the attitudes of poor southern whites, and some of whom said essentially, well, this is a slave owners' war. Even if you keep the slaves in chains, and I go and fight and die for that, it doesn't put any money in my pocket at all. So there were kind of schisms within white society, minor ones, I would probably say, but definitely some schisms in white society on the eve of the Civil War in the South.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because that difference in white attitude that does tend to be presented quite homogeneously at times is that I think it was over 75% of white Southerners didn't own slaves.
Yeah.
We also have a difference in white faith, in that Southern whites are going to argue they're doing God's work and Northern whites are going to argue they're doing God's work, but they're obviously trying to achieve opposite ends. Yeah. So considerable differences there. I think another problem is that Northern whites, I'm talking 19th century Northern whites, are painted very much as the good guys, with, front and foremost among them, Abraham Lincoln, the great liberator. Mm. You know, what's the most famous image of Lincoln is probably the one of him and the ex-slave on Crooked Knee being raised up by Lincoln's, you know, a master of early propaganda, really. If we consider that I think it was 1858, Lincoln says, if I can save the Union by not freeing a single slave, I would do that. If I can save the Union by freeing every slave, I would do that. And if I can save the Union by freeing some slaves and not freeing others, I would do that. Which I think is a very, very helpful quote in understanding where Black Lives Matter falls within that 19th century prism. It's the secondary, if that, tertiary consideration.
Absolutely, and that explains the nature of the final emancipation, where slaves are emancipated without land.
They are emancipated without land, but up until 1865, the Emancipation Proclamation manages to liberate slaves that were still under Southern rule and free them under Northern rule, but which they didn't want to do because they didn't want to upset the white slave owners there. So it's definitely, the proclamation is is something of fiction, right? Hopeful intentions rather than, you know, this great idea, January the 1st, 1863, all the slaves are free. Well, sadly not true.
The poverty into which African Americans are liberated obviously creates the context for their further exploitation. The southern plantation owners knew their desperation. A great many were unable to move very far from where the actual plantation was. They were victims of violent intimidation, really, to stay put, because the plantation owners now needed a cheap workforce. And so for many African Americans, life on the plantation basically resumes. They have de jure freedoms, but de facto kind of oppression, really.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, you can free a slavery from slavery. What's it going to do? Go and be a journalist. The black community finds itself kind of constrained by the skills. Now, the skills that they have are agricultural. They're southern skills. Hence why when the war is over, a whole load of black people don't look to emigrate to the north, which they have as much in common with as in the 1830s when it was argued black should relocate back to Africa. You know, the North is as foreign as Africa to these people. They are Southerners, and hence the vast majority end up as sharecroppers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's what the situation allowed. Yeah, absolutely. But there's a thought here. It's certainly present in Republican ideology, and it certainly is at the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, which we'll move on to, is that when you give black people legal equality, you give them the vote, you give them the right to do whatever a white man can do, then you see a lot of white, you know, wash their hands, fine, that's the black problem solved and history will remember us for our benevolence.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to assume something about you, Nick, that probably same for me. I don't have a mansion. I'm assuming you don't. We law allows us to. Why don't we have a mansion? It's because we can't afford it. So if freedom allows black people in the 19th century to do what their hearts do their hearts content, then you can see this is a fallacy. It's just white people thinking I've solved a problem, but not actually understanding what, or caring perhaps, what this problem is.
Yeah, well, and it comes back to notion, pre-existing notions of kind of rugged individualism and the expanding frontier, and you know, existing and you know, living and dying on your own merits, and all this kind of stuff, which is, you know, fine words, but when you have centuries of structural inequality. To refer to slavery as a structural inequality is almost kind of like an absurdity. It almost kind of trivializes it. But centuries of oppression, the expectation that somebody can then leave slavery and can then, you know, progress without the playing field being fundamentally altered. This is it. I suppose the classic example, and I always very kind of wary of this example, is Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington's famous book was Up From Slavery, in which he essentially kind of exhorted other African Americans to, you know, do it yourself. Don't go looking for any further, you know, the white folk have been perfectly fair with us, and now we must buck our ideas up. But because he was probably a colossal narcissist, I'm guessing, and looking from his perspective of, well, if I did it, you can, which really kind of fails to understand the context of the lives of most African Americans spectacularly, but. Booker T. Washington was kind of the darling of the white establishment. He was welcomed to the White House as a kind of a good, reliable Negro who would be, you know, who wasn't going to cause lots of trouble, basically.
Right, here's the blueprint.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And his contemporaries call him out on this quite spectacularly. Not to say that he wasn't, you know, exceedingly popular amongst African Americans at the time, because he is, and he, you know, lots of people listened to him. W.B. Du Bois was hugely critical of him and said, you know, that this is a political struggle, and he's speaking at a time where the Jim Crow laws, this is the kind of the fallacy in, I think, in Washington's arguments. He's speaking at a time where the Jim Crow laws are at their height, meaning that there are huge structural and legal barriers to people, African-Americans being educated, owning property, even sitting on juries.
Well, I think another point I kind of wonder, and I might be a little bit off here, but Booker T. Washington's accommodationism is kind of, I believe, is a root of his Southern birth. I think he was a Virginian, whereas W.E.B. Du Bois is a Massachusetts man, a Northern, and you see this difference presented in the 20th century movement as well, with this kind of, we'll call it for now, radical moderate approach. But I think that is exactly that. So Booker T. Washington is popular primarily in the South, in the same way that Martin Luther King from Georgia is also primarily, you know, internationally as well, but primarily popular in the South, whereas your Malcolm X's and Huey Newton, Bobby Seals, etc., carry less weight in the South. And, you know, just seeing Du Bois and Booker T as almost the avant-garde of those two movements, there's a geographical thing going on there, I feel.
It's really important, what you say is really, really important from the perspective of studying this from outside, you know, studying this from Great Britain. Because once again, the temptation, and perhaps this happens when you teach this at a particular level, the temptation to see black movements as homogenous is definitely there. And obviously they're not. There are schisms and debates and disagreements and, angry confrontations between different branches of what is roughly a kind of a broad family of movements. Which brings us on to the civil rights movement itself. And once again, I want to return to this notion that we have in our kind of pedagogy in Great Britain of it is the story of kind of triumph and progress. Now, my confusion, and this goes all the way back, long way, went to when I was studying this at school, was, hang on, so the Second World War ends, you know, we agree that the racist fascist regime of Nazism, they were definitely the bad guys. So in 1945, these black people returning from service realise that oppression isn't necessarily compulsory, and they decide to do something about it, and over 20 or 30 years, they have a series of successes. And even then, that story seemed to be, there seemed to be holes in it somewhere. There is a sort of an element of truth to that, that there was an empowered generation after 1945. But actually, one thing that gets left out of the story is the terrific violence that returning black GIs and munitions workers and every other branch of black society that had been part of the victory, the terrific violence that is meted out on them by white vigilantes and groups in sort of 1945-46. And there's an echo of it. If you look at in 1919, the Red Summer of 1919, where once again, after the upheavals of the war, white society tries to kind of reassert itself. I think there's a two interesting historical moments there. I say interesting, extremely violent and distressing, but the story of the civil rights movement, anyway, that we tell, is often lacks nuance, I would say, and the period for the 50s and 60s is much more complex.
Yeah, because you've got that level that you're discussing as well, and I think the other thing that's kind of presented, at least in the British curriculum's handling of the civil rights movement, is essentially that Martin Luther King was the good guy, his protests are non-violent, therefore he appeals to government, well, that he appeals to anyone who's not a radical or, you know, radical leftist or a radical rightist. But Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam tend to be presented as, well, you know, we're going to handle something a little bit sensitive today. Here are these crazy people. This is what they wanted. They didn't even have any nice sit-down protests. You know, these guys were violent. And you kind of almost feel that, well, it's very dependent on the teacher's own view, isn't it? I was always a bit more ambivalent about Martin Luther King in my teaching and far more enthusiastic on Black Power as a whole, really.
Yeah.
Because there is this kind of, you know, teachers obviously have their own political beliefs as well, which lead them that way. But first time teaching this, 2008, is that that moment in the course, and you mentioned the terms earlier, de jure and de facto, when you actually figure out there are two civil rights movements, there's the southern one and the northern one, and how, as I said earlier, that there's very limited crossover between the both, probably best symbolised by Martin Luther King and Malcolm X having met each other once, I think, for about 5 minutes at the signing of the 64 Civil Rights Act. So two different campaigns, two different methodologies from two different roots, yet it all comes from the same root issue, which is racial equality. And I would argue it's racial equality from two perspectives. It's the hope to achieve it, and it's the determination to prevent it.
Yeah.
Kind of like yin and yang.
I think.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And absolutely, the determination to prevent it, that comes from that very, very dark place. That, again, I don't think in some ways is kind of underexplored. I mean, there you would say that there's a legitimate argument for underexploring it because these are the bad guys. But in a way, to understand how inequality, how discrimination, how racism and racist violence function, you kind of need to look a little bit at the quote unquote bad guys. Understand what it is they believed was at stake. I think in the case of the Martin Luther King and the non-violent movement, there is, because we live in a kind of relatively pluralistic liberal society where violence is discouraged, what filters down through kind of government kind of guiding of teaching curriculums and then through exam boards and then through to textbooks and then through to teachers is this idea that really the non-violent movement was really rather wonderful and and violent movements. Well, you know, they were hot under the collar about certain things, but you know, we should perhaps, you know, there should be kind of an implicit kind of not making too much out of that. But I'm reminded about, there was a thing that I was reading an essay about Arundhati Roy, who was talking about the Naxalite rebels in India, who are Marxist rebels, who when policemen who are essentially paid by landowners and Indian corporations come to demolish villages that have been there for 1,000 years in order to build a bauxite quarry or something like that, the villagers shoot back. And she said it's actually offensive to tell those people to engage in passive resistance when they're the ones that are killed, their wives are raped, they're chased off their land. You know, you've no right to tell them to engage in
totally.
And
totally.
When you look at the Black Panthers and the Nation of Islam, yeah, I mean, their struggle against, you know, police officers shooting them is entirely legitimate.
Well, so Martin Luther King's strategy, or at least one strand of his strategy, is to invoke white police violence against black protesters,
yes,
for the greater good. And then of course there's a rationale there. If you look at Birmingham, black civil rights leaders have debates in 1963 whether they should allow children to participate in the protests. I think it was the recently deceased John Lewis who says, come on, these are children. We cannot put children on the front line. And I believe it's Martin Luther King, not only Martin Luther King, but says this will get us the press that we need for our solution.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about you, Nick. I don't want to be that black guy waiting to get clubbed around the head at best so that other people can have their rights improved. You know, what does Malcolm X say? Because Malcolm X, you know, I think his sense of humour is quite underrated, really. But give me a 45 caliber and then I'll sing We Will Overcome. And I think that's it.
Yeah. Well, obviously Martin Luther King has many important qualities.
Mm-hmm.
I am always wary of any kind of, and it's not the role of a history teacher to deify or to kind of make a saint out of anybody. And I think that what's happening now, I think this is a good thing, but there is more critical analysis of Martin Luther King. Because despite his many achievements, there were, you know, miscalculations and missteps, and also downright moments of downright cynicism like that, like you described there.
Yeah.
Which maybe it worked, maybe it didn't, but that's kind of beside the point. I want to fast forward now slightly to get his, you know, obviously King is assassinated in 1968. There is this again, another fallacy that we seem to teach is this impression that post 1968 the Black Power movement begins, and it doesn't. It begins, you know, significantly earlier than that, several years earlier than that. There's a period of rioting in 1968, but again, the rioting had begun significantly earlier than that. There was rioting, I think Watts was 65.
65, yeah.
The period of the 1970s, which is again something that I think that most British history teachers of civil rights, they're not quite sure what to do with the 70s, and the fact that rather inconveniently for them, the great demon Nixon actually does a couple of reasonably progressive things. I mean, because he didn't believe in it. It's like, and you think Kennedy and Johnson particularly,
why?
You know, really? I think. You know, the kind of the liberal naivety about both Kennedy and Johnson is partly responsible for that.
Well, I don't want to sound disrespectful, but it's amazing what an assassination does for your reputation. Because if you look at characters within this conversation, Abraham Lincoln, John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, perhaps Malcolm X is the odd one out there who doesn't quite receive that deification upon being assassinated.
Sure. And the one we haven't mentioned is Bobby, who was considered, you know, the greatest president we never had, and who would obviously have sorted out all the problems.
Yeah.
Again, which, you know, we shall never know, but we, you know, you need to kind of really kind of approach these characters not as necessarily as angels or demons, but as kind of flawed and complicated human beings that we need to sort of look at from a critical perspective. Moving on to the period that I find most interesting is this period of kind of the rescinding of the civil rights movement in the 1980s. And it's done with immense sort of subtlety by Reagan. The idea that the kind of the repealing of welfare measures, which predominantly affect Black communities, and the refusal really to kind of endorse even the most minor kind of progressive changes, sees a huge kind of structural shift within American society. Of course, you know, the advent of neoliberalism in America has huge implications for white people, for Latino people and Native Americans, but particularly for African Americans. And there's this demonization of welfare recipients, again, which predominantly affects African Americans, and this kind of the creation of this sort of like this folk devil of the welfare queen. How do you see that period, Larry?
It's almost like, I don't know, it's hard to talk about this without being controversial, but it's almost like the lights are off, no one's, the world's eyes aren't on us anymore. What can we scrape back from what we very reluctantly gave over? And, you know, Reagan's attacks on the dependency culture, we've seen the same in this country with Thatcherism, and without that race level to the same extent as in America. Yeah. But what we see in America is basically, and it's what you see today, is the poorest communities in America are Black. And the 1980s, well, listen, I wouldn't call the 1960s paradise found, but if we went for that, we could go paradise lost for the 80s, because probably my first memory of the civil rights for that huge umbrella term would be the beating to death of Rodney King, which is, what, 91, is it? Very early 90s, I believe.
Yeah.
So you get the idea that it's almost a forgotten period from historians, because we're still cheering those victories of 68. And you know, that's my personal view, that civil rights wasn't such a political hot potato in that decade, and other things, maybe the Cold War were, I don't know.
I think there were various things, you know, throughout the 1970s, the Black Power movement, particularly the Black Panther movement, had been crushed by the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
There was the epidemic, the sort of the development of crack in Black ghettos, and I'm not sort of sufficiently versed on the history here to go into the realms of kind of CIA conspiracy theories, but my understanding is that there is rather a lot in that argument of the helping of crack to take hold in Black neighborhoods, but that's a conversation for another time, perhaps when I read a few more books on it. And there is this kind of sort of like crypto racism, if you will. If you go back to Nixon in 68, where he talked to this white silent majority, and he said, you know, I know your problem is crime. You know, you're worried about crime, and crime was a code for the Black man.
Yeah.
You know, the burglar, the rapist, that kind of thing. And in the 1980s, this idea of ending welfare dependency, ending freeloaders and scroungers and people who were taking everybody else for a ride, Well, you allowed white Americans who wanted tax cuts to say, well, yeah, you know, I'm not being racist. I mean, freeloaders could be of any colour, couldn't they, really? But it just so happens that when they're mentioned in kind of on talk radio and in other places, and we must hear mark the passing of Rush Limbaugh yesterday, that, you know, the world is a pleasanter place without him. Who really pioneered this idea of the, you know, the lazy black freeloader. And what Reagan was able to do was to tap into this kind of like this culture of resentment, which had existed in some form since the 1960s, and was basically a racism that couldn't speak its name. There were certain things after the 60s you couldn't say anymore. There are certain things you can't say on the TV and the radio anymore, overtly racist things, or in newspapers. So you have to find other ways of sub-communicating it. And there were, you know, surrounding people like Nixon first, then Reagan, were some very, very skillful political theorists on the dark side. And the period of the 1990s, again, which was a period mainly of democratic hegemony, was once again a period, and the new President Biden was hugely responsible for this, of the growing mass incarceration of African Americans, which in some ways, because of the 13th Amendment, says, you know, you can extract slave labor from people that have committed crimes. It brings us in many ways full circle from the plantations of huge numbers of incarcerated people.
I think there's an element of it as well that, you know, race relations were a big thing for the white community, even, you know, by association rather than directly affect them. So if you have your Nixons, your Reagans saying, OK, listen, I think we've solved this problem. What we've now got is a problem that's colourless. It's people being scroungers, basically. Now, it's not a race issue. Any race can be a scrounger. And then when it comes down to it, all the coverages of Black Americans, Hispanics, Mexicans, well, I'm not, you know, I haven't made it a race issue. But here, taking this theory forward, you see that it is a race issue. And I think that's quite pleasing in a way to, sorry, I don't like to talk about white America because that's such a kind of sweeping generalisation, but there's that kind of comfort as well, you know. And
you start to articulate a kind of a racist thesis once again of, well, you know, I'm not saying that it's that black people are, you know, the problem in our society, but they're just, you know, there just seem to be something there, doesn't there? You know, and allowing people to make, therefore, racist conclusions.
That's right. We're not saying black Mexicans and Hispanics are criminals, but there's a disproportionate amount of them in our federal prison system. Therefore,
yeah. And that is to extract a kind of structural critique of poverty and crime. You know, obviously, when people who live in impoverished neighbourhoods where social support systems have collapsed and families are in chaos, unsurprisingly, become more likely to commit offences. Anyway, so take us into the current historical moment. We've had the violence against, you mentioned Rodney King, violence against Black Americans has continued unabated, and continued unabated throughout the Obama period. But Trump is the first president to really officially sanction it. He makes comments like, you know, if you're getting somebody into a police car, make sure you whack their head off the door, and officially...
You'll miss that diplomacy.
Oh yeah. I mean, his he sort of is very explicit about this, knowing that his base will lap it up, and the more kind of outrageous and offensive and shocking he is,
The more followers he gets.
Yeah, the more it helps to outmaneuver his opponents. And I sometimes think with Trump that it's important not to apply too much logic to what he does. I think his sort of racist proclivities in the first place. His racist kind of instincts in the first place. If you go back to the case of the Central Park jogger rape, where he put an article, I think it was an advert in the New York Times, demanding the execution of those who were accused, who turned out obviously to be innocent. He was renowned for his birtherism against Obama, and came with a kind of a track record of overt racism into office. And there were large numbers of his supporters that I suppose kind of expect this, and they expect their kind of racist grievances to be articulated. But with the Black Lives Matter movement, which I said is, you know, really a kind of continuation, not just of the civil rights movement, but over the overall struggle for Black emancipation in America. The thing that is exciting and fascinating and extraordinary is when you saw the protests last year, they were the most kind of mixed race, multicultural, multi-generational protests for progressive change that I think have ever been seen in America, perhaps outside the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think maybe there's a lot has happened since the end of the civil rights movement, if we're using that 68-year as bookend, and all the things that the world has gone through, Vietnam, well, all wars since then, even if you look at COVID, I suppose, how everyone is impacted the same, you know, and I wonder if this has been a kind of deep seeping realization for liberal America that what Black Lives Matter were asking for is nothing beyond what white people have had for, let's say, century as a kind of ballpark figure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that I've never felt disadvantaged going for a job because of my, well, I suppose gender's the other one that we can come on to a different time, but ethnicity, when I've been trying to buy a house, I haven't found myself disadvantaged in any way. And I wonder if it has just been like, the extremism of a police officer with his knee on the neck of George Floyd for 7 minutes, that people see that and they see, you know, how can someone's son or someone's father get that type of treatment when we know that would not happen to us? This isn't some abstract stop and search, not to belittle that whole argument, but this is literally life and death. And that's why I think the movement had followers, supporters who would not have considered themselves necessarily supporters of the civil rights movement. I don't know about that. But I really think like the role of media in flashing these images on our phone, on our TV, on our social media, almost as instantly as they happen, has really given the world a bit of a conscience, might be a bit kind of John Lennon down that line, but I wonder.
I mean, firstly, I think the irony for the modern racist is that they got the president they wanted in 2016, and the modern misogynist as well. And the instant reaction was a galvanization of civil society in America, from the massive marches of American women against this sort of explicit and outspoken misogynistic and misogynist and sort of sexual offender.
Ridiculous character.
Yeah. This, and also the Black Lives Matter movement, which, you know, really in the last summer was really actually an immensely successful movement, and shifted the kind of the discourse on race and inequality in America in ways that it had not moved in decades. You know, there wasn't, after Rodney King, the same sort of movement, in small part because you had figures like Clinton, who said, well, in essence, you know, yeah, this is bad, and society really shouldn't be like this. Not that they did an awful lot to do anything other than introduce obviously mass incarceration for African Americans. So Trump, in a way, has been the kind of the shot in the arm to civil society, and the kind of the galvanizer of civil society. He sought to divide and polarize American society. He thought, you know, the way that I win is I kind of whip my base up into some kind of rage, some frenzy. They'll get me into power. And it's like, well, generally, American and indeed British politics doesn't work like that. I mean, it is creating an alliance of your base and the people in the middle. So you create an electoral block of about the 60%, and that gets you over the line. But I can't imagine somebody who's had six bankruptcies to probably grasp that one. Anyway, there we must leave it for now. I do hope we can have some more of these fruitful conversations, Larry. It's been great to have you back on the podcast again.
Thanks for having me.
We will catch up soon. And you can always, if you're a student of modern Chinese history, you can find mine and Larry's book, which was called
The Making of Modern China, 1860 to 1997, available online in charity shops. Where else, Nick?
Mainly in those two places.
Yeah, our bookshelves.
Yes. Thanks very much, Larry, and I'll catch you soon.
Cheers. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.